You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We will not be intimidated. We will be vigilant, but we will not run scared. We will be prudent, but we will not panic. And as for the business of government, well, here we are in our seats, in our chamber, in the very heart of our democracy.
Canada attempts to assimilate two apparent Islamist terror attacks in a week, including one on its parliament. Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Jeffrey Kaufman will be joining me in the studio to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including looming elections in Brazil and Tunisia and the runaway mayor of Iguala. We'll also be hearing from our correspondent in Amsterdam, and in Hong Kong we'll find out what a modern protest song sounds like.
One especially vulgar song, with curse words in every line, ridiculed those who criticized the democracy protesters.
And Kathy Rensenbrink will be here to discuss the week's big book releases. That's all coming up right now on Midori House on Monocle 24. So, lots coming up in the next 60 minutes, but ahead of that, Jonathan Wheatley has the world news.
The Canadian Governor-General, David Johnston, has said today that he extends his sympathies to the family of the soldier shot dead by a gunman in central Ottawa on Wednesday, and called the shooting and the consequent attack on Parliament by a reported convert to Islam deeply shocking and saddening.
The violent acts carried out in our capital yesterday were deeply shocking and saddening. I would like to extend my gratitude to the first responders and security personnel who acted with such professionalism. Their courageous efforts at such a time are a great comfort and inspiration to us all.
Well, the Prime Minister Stephen Harper has pledged more surveillance and detention powers for security forces in Canada after that gunman, Michael Zehaf Bibou, killed the soldier. He also said that the country will not be intimidated. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's London correspondent Nala Ayed said that despite increased security measures, people were returning to work.
Obviously, the day after an attack like this, there will be intense security, and I'm sure you heard about some of those measures being taken across the country. In the fact that they're back to work, in the fact that the legislator in Ontario was back to work normally, there is this fight back in that, you know what, you know, Canadians will not be cowed, they will not be scared into changing the way they're doing things. But I think the reality is that it will be difficult to avoid.
Suspected Boko Haram militants have kidnapped at least 25 girls in an attack on a remote town in northeastern Nigeria, witnesses have said, despite talks on freeing over 200 other female hostages they seized back in April. The attack casts further doubt on government reports that it has secretly reached a temporary ceasefire with the rebels in order to secure the release of more than 200 schoolgirls they are holding hostage. European Union leaders are in Brussels for talks on climate change. The summit will focus on agreeing a deal to cut carbon emissions. The European Commission has proposed a 40% cut by 2030. Monocle's Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson is in the Belgian capital.
There's always lots of pre-negotiations in the run-up to these meetings, and usually we have the draft conclusions and we know pretty much what to expect, but there's no draft conclusions at the moment on these climate change targets because there's just so much controversy over the burden for each nation.
The leaders will also seek to boost measures to stop the spread of Ebola. A Tunisian policeman has been killed today when security forces clashed with Islamist militants on the outskirts of the capital Tunis, an Interior Ministry spokesman has just said, as the country prepares for parliamentary elections. Police negotiators were trying to persuade militants to surrender after surrounding a house in Oued Eli, west of Tunis, following heavy exchanges of gunfire. And finally, in Wales, police have released surveillance footage today showing a man claiming to suffer from quadriplegia in order to avoid appearing in court, driving a car and walking unassisted. South Wales police took Alan Knight to Swansea Crown Court to face charges of theft and forgery after he allegedly took more than £40,000 from an elderly neighbour. Knight was presented with the surveillance video and, after seeing the footage, he did admit all charges and is due to face sentencing next month. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 here in London. That'll be 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University here in London, and the correspondent and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman. Welcome both. We will start in Canada a day after an attack on its National War Memorial and Parliament House by a lone gunman, apparently a Canadian convert to Islam, left one Canadian soldier dead, and that came, of course, 2 days after a hit-and-run attack in Quebec by another Muslim convert killed another soldier. Jeffrey, Canadian as you are, I will ask you first. Stephen Harper, we heard at the top of the program saying, well, I paraphrase very slightly, saying Canada would react prudently but not panic. Is that a fair assessment of what's likely to happen?
I think that we're going to see Harper use this as an opportunity to extend surveillance, to limit human rights. I think Harper's already been moving in that direction prior to this incident and the incident 3 days ago in which another soldier was killed in a similar kind of random act. Naturally, Canadians are alarmed. Harper, who is very much a law and order conservative leader, who doesn't consider the nuance of human rights to be something to worry about terribly, is going to have an opportunity now. The window is open for him to go out and extend the reach of government. And you know, obviously, people are frightened. People are anxious. These are horrific acts, both of them, the one in Quebec 3 days ago, the one in Ottawa. And so people will be less inclined to stand up and say, wait. Now, on the other hand, you know, this guy was under surveillance. They had taken his passport away. So the system knew about him, but the system failed. He clearly was more of a threat than simply being somebody who should be on a watch list. Harper will argue we need the power to detain people like that. And again, I think Canadians are so numbed by this. The peaceable kingdom has been seen its peace shattered.
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, just to pick up that point, as Jeffrey was pointing out, the suspect, Michael Zehaf Bibau, was known to the authorities, as the euphemism goes, to the extent that they'd taken his passport away. Does that demonstrate that really Canada did have enough laws and processes in place to deal with people like him? It's just that they weren't correctly pursued. Does Canada basically need to pass any more laws of this sort?
Well, as Jeffrey suggested, there is probably no need for that. And in fact, these occurrences, horrible as they may be, seem to have become the pretext of choice for politicians around the world to of a certain persuasion to go and shatter our most precious liberties. Again, this is a story well known. We have already heard this story. The one petty criminal, as he has been described, a drug addict who commits an act of terrorism is immediately deemed a terrorist, even though we have no confirmation that he is part of a terrorist organization. And then as panic sweeps through the population, our liberties are destroyed.
And I would say also that it must be an incredibly uncomfortable time to be a Muslim in Canada and in so many other places. But the kind of scrutiny now, that the heightened scrutiny that people, you know, law-abiding citizens will face, and the kind of subtle racial profiling that's inevitable. And when you see two converts to Islam in 3 days murder soldiers in Canada, there are no evident links to ISIS, but there are clear links to the kind of the ideology that's being spread and talked about in the media. And these are disenfranchised young men who feel somehow that by aligning themselves with that, they somehow have some sort of legitimacy in their horrendous acts.
Jeffrey, you are, of course, not just a Canadian, but a journalist. What have you made of the Canadian media's coverage of this? There's been a lot of compare and contrast floating around between how Canada covers this versus how America covers not only this, but something
very
similar.
Very interesting question. You know, before I moved to American television almost 20 years ago, I was a correspondent with Canadian Broadcasting Corporation with CBC National News. And it's very interesting. People have been talking about this. The CBC, which has been really struggling in the face of massive budget cuts from the federal government, has been praised for not having hyperventilating graphics and lots of loud music, saying nothing saying terror on Parliament Hill. In fact, American commentators are looking north and saying, wow, this is how you can do it without making yourself look like total fools. And it really is interesting because Peter Mansbridge, the chief anchor at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, who's been there forever, just handled it with absolute equanimity, wouldn't get into the realm of speculation, was very careful to say, you know, these are things awaiting confirmation. They were not the first to report that the soldier had died. They wanted to get it right. And it's so interesting. If you actually, if you just look online, you'll see the comparisons to CNN and Fox and this kind of race to be first, even if you're wrong. The Canadian media culture is somewhere between the UK and the US. It is a more sober culture, and it is a lot less sensationalist. And I guess Canadians can take some comfort in that.
Final thought on this, Oscar, not wishing to belittle at all the enormity of either of these crimes, but do you think that we still, not just as media, but as countries and societies as a whole, have a tendency to overreact to events like this?
Absolutely. I think we should denounce all these attempts to make us believe that we will somehow conquer evil, that terribly abused word, by externalizing it. I'm absolutely tired of being given a new enemy to hate every 5 weeks. I can take it anymore.
But can I just say that you're right, and I agree with you. But as a Canadian and as a reporter who's spent a lot of time in the House of Commons and in Ottawa and visiting as a citizen, even if it was many years ago, it is incredibly unsettling to see shots fired. I don't know if you've seen the cell phone video that was broadcast, a Globe and Mail reporter.
It is extraordinary. We shall move on from there to the Southern Americas. On Sunday, Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, faces a runoff election in her bid for a second term. She faces a situation which few would have predicted 6 months ago, both in terms of the identity of her opponent, Aseio Neves, and the anticipated closeness of the vote. Oscar, ask you first, how has she ended up in this position? For months, this was assumed to be an election she really only had to turn up for.
Well, part of it has to do with the usual exhaustion of a party that has been in government for quite some time. On the other hand, there are problems and people are concerned. There are some who are concerned about inflation and the state of the economy. There are others, and those tend to support Aseio Neves. There are others who are more concerned about the fact that the Workers' Party, led by Dilma Rousseff, has made too many compromises, and that although they recognized that social programs such as Bolsa Família had lifted 36 million people out of poverty, those who are no longer hungry for food are, as the theologian Leonardo Boff put it, now hungry for health and education, and they believe she has not done enough. That's part of the reason why the Workers' Party loyalists are not flocking behind her. Having said that, right now the polls are already saying that Aseio Neves' support is going down. His unfavorable image is going up, which might give some comfort to Dilma's party.
Jeffrey, there's an almost cartoonish competing narrative here. You have the patrician playboy Aseio Neves versus the former Marxist guerrilla Dilma Rousseff. Is that the kind of thing, do you think, that people, especially in a economically advancing country, still vote on, or will it come down to James Carville's dictum, it's the economy, stupid?
Well, you know, I don't think it is just cartoonish. I think that what's really interesting to me as an observer of this election is that, in fact, you have two very different approaches to solving the problem. problem. And you know, it's not surprising that a country with massive poverty would support the Workers' Party of Dilma Rousseff. But the reality is she hasn't been able to solve them to the satisfaction of even the workers. Now you've got this, as you say, playboy from a scene of industry of a very wealthy family coming in and saying, you know what, this nationalization, this anti-business climate is not good for everyone, including the people at the bottom. And you can understand why there is some attraction to that. People are saying, you know, she's tried, and before that it was Lula, but we're not moving fast enough. In fact, GDP is pretty much stalled. It's actually going negative. Well, some of the neighboring countries in Latin America are still moving forward aggressively with GDP growth. So, I think if you consider it the Conservative Party in Britain versus the Labour Party, and the Labour Party being Dilma, having been in for more than a decade, people are saying, well, maybe a different approach to these problems might resolve it.
I mean, Oscar, is it as simple as that? It is often the case when one party has been power in a long time that there's a sense the country just gets frankly bored with them. Well, that tends to happen. But we should not belittle the achievements of the Workers' Party, because Brazilians themselves are not doing so. To lift out of abject poverty 36 million people is an incomparable achievement. It's a huge achievement. And most people in Brazil, according to the recent polls, are also very afraid of losing the social gains obtained during the Workers' Party's leadership to someone whose political outlook seems unsavory to quite a few. I mean, his father was a supporter of the dictatorship. There are accusations about nepotism, throughout his Aécio Neves's leadership in the state of Minas Gerais, the same state where Dilma comes from. And clearly, you have two opposing stories, which do tell volumes about the two dissimilar approaches to not only solving the problem of the economy, but also of Brazil's position vis-a-vis world affairs. Let us also remind ourselves that Neves is seen with sympathetic eyes, not only by financiers and captains of industry in Brazil, but also by those who would like to see Brazil return to the fold of the U.S., to its 1970s role as a client of American interests in the Southern Hemisphere. Does America, and I'll ask you, Jeffrey, as an onlooker to this, do you get the sense that South America is getting to the point of starting to care less what America thinks than it might have done even 10 years ago?
You know, I covered the region for ABC News for 10 years, and I think it's not that they care less. I think that what's happened, there are a number of other influences. First of all, the growth of democracy in the last 30, 40 years in the region is astonishing, and perhaps one of the most underreported stories of the last generation or two. You do see in Brazil in particular massive investment from China, where the U.S. is not investing huge amounts. China has a rapacious appetite for the raw materials of the world, and Brazil, with as a custodian of many of those raw materials, is seeing massive investment not only in mineral exploitation, but also in things like port facilities. And the U.S. is simply not a player at the same level. That being said, there is a perception in the U.S. that under Dilma and under Lula prior to her, that Brazil's not open for business in that American sense, and that Neves might change that.
And just finally, Oscar, if you're betting money on it?
I am, absolutely. I'm absolutely sure that Dilma will win the election. But again, it will not be by a huge margin, and that will be a wake-up call to the Workers' Party.
Although, remember, in the first round, not so many weeks ago, Neves did better than the poll suggested. So there is the potential of an underreporting by the polls.
Well, in this case, the decision will be with the 6% of people who have not made their minds just yet, and it's very unlikely that Aécio Neves will have the time and the story to tell to persuade them.
Well, let's hope neither of you have done your own Dewey defeats Truman moment there. We will certainly remind you of it if you have. We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Jeffrey Kaufman. When we return, we will attempt to succeed where many others are presently failing and seeing if we can figure out what is going on in the Mexican town of Iguala.
What do you need to build a better city? Tech-savvy urban app builders, hipsters, will take a neglected hood and fill it with quality coffee stores and too many beards. A mayor who's a hard hitter and crack-free, or perhaps some oddballs to liven things up and keep the world a little less well-behaved. On our show, The Urbanist, we've met them all, and many more extraordinary and ordinary people besides, who form the chorus for a good city show.
If all we build is concrete and glass boxes with nothing really cool in between them, it's not as interesting or sustainable or valid a place to live as we're used to. So we got to get back to that thinking.
This one-hour program looks at all the key urban debates, from density to smart cities, but it's not a talking shop for those who think they know best. The Urbanist makes the city human, sees the quirks and contradictions that turn a collection of buildings into a place where people actually want to live. Join us each week on the only show about the cities we live in. It's hosted by me, Andrew Tuck, and it premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours. Join us.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Jeffrey Kaufman. We'll look now at Mexico, where the saga of the 43 students who vanished after a political rally last month is not becoming any less peculiar. Warrants have now been issued for the arrests of Iguala's mayor, Jose Luis Abaca, his wife, and the town's police chief. All three have now themselves vanished and are considered fugitives. Oscar, briefly first, could you just remind us a bit of what actually happened as far as anyone understands it on September 26th?
Well, the current version of facts goes like this. The wife of the mayor of Iguala had a confrontation with the students of the teaching college of Ayotzinapa before. And she was about to give a speech, and apparently she ordered her husband and his people to do away with the students. And to put it mildly, they took the orders literally.
Jeffrey, even by the shocking standards of drug and organized crime-related violence in Mexico, this does take... It takes a certain amount of assimilation. A city mayor basically ordering 43 murders to avoid upsetting his wife.
Yeah, it is. It is astonishing. Mexico has been really ravaged by violence and gangs and drug cartels. Really, as Colombia has regained power and control of its territory, Mexico has, and some of the Central American countries have suffered most. So we're used to it. But you're right. These are the kind of horrors that make you go, you're kidding. Can this really happen? But the problem is that Mexico, parts of Mexico are lawless states. And the mayor in this case has actually, the suggestion is, and the evidence is, that he actually had a kind of detente with the drug gangs and said, you know, we won't bug you if you protect me. And that they're the ones who have their fingerprints on these disappeared and presumed dead students.
Oscar, if the prosecutor's version of events is true, how common, even if it doesn't always result in absolute horror shows like this, how often is this kind of cooperation, apparent cooperation between drugs gangs, police, and politicians?
Look, I've spent 2 or 3 weeks just a few days ago in Mexico, and everybody, you know, I was there when the disappearance of these students took place, and everybody had already told me beforehand that these things were happening. The version that everybody would repeat is this is no longer criminals, you know, wrecking havoc and sort of anarchical situation. This is the ghost of the revolutionary institutional parties. Perfect democracy rearing its ugly head once more, by which they meant that now the drug trafficking violence has become intertwined with the state. In fact, this particular event has a political veneer to it more than just a confrontation between gangs. because these students from the Ayotzipan Teaching College are well known for being rebellious. They are a well-known left-leaning part of a left-leaning college. And the mayor and his wife were clearly giving orders to cleanse them because of their political appearance. As a Colombian, that rings a bell immediately. It rings horrendous bells, because that's the point when this is no longer a matter of petty criminals, gangs, or very powerful criminal organizations. This is the moment when the politics and these powerful economic interests become one. And people will tell you in Mexico that the proprietary classes as a whole, and they include by this, in this under this denomination, the politicians, you know, the very wealthy people like Carlos Slim and others, but also these the powerful economic interests of the cartels have now become one. And this is the reason why Mexico is descending into the downward spiral of violence and plunder that we saw in Colombia a decade ago.
Just staying with that and picking up Jeffrey's point there, that Colombia has had a certain measure of detaching that association or that intimacy, if you will, between organized crime and between the alleged forces of law and order. Are there lessons there that Mexico could draw on?
I do hope so, because unfortunately, I remember when I was there some years ago during the PAN administration of Felipe Calderón, and the Mexicans were drawing the wrong lessons. They were applying the lessons that were applied by the Uribe government of Colombia a decade ago. And the application of the of that recipe of looking the other way while this violence takes place resulted in the disappearance of some 40,000 people in Colombia in one decade. Now, the numbers, and you were asking about them, in Mexico right now are, you know, just astonishing. According to some of these numbers, only in 2012, some 20,658 young people have died in Mexico because of violent causes.
Okay, we need to look finally and unfortunately briefly at Tunisia, where ahead of parliamentary elections due on Sunday, violence has flared today. One police officer reported dead in a clash with Islamist militants on the outskirts of Tunis. Jeffrey, Tunisia is often regarded as a relative success story of the post-Arab Spring states.
In fact, it's the only real bright light in the Arab Spring.
Yeah, Libya, Egypt, and Syria are, of course, low bars to get over. How worrying is this development today?
I think what's worrying, you know, I covered the Arab Spring in Tunisia and Libya, and I think what's worrying about what we're seeing is, you know, isolated incidents of violence. We just talked about Canada can happen, but there's a broader issue in allowing civil liberties in Tunisia under the new constitution of 2011. What they didn't anticipate was that it would allow extremist ideologies to flourish as well.
This and is the trouble with freedom of speech.
Well, and what's happened is, in fact, Tunisia has become one of the main suppliers of recruits to ISIS, and this extremist ideology has a lot of it carries a lot of weight in Tunisia, because there is still massive youth unemployment, massive disenchantment, and what you learn from this is that while freedom is wonderful and of course it's something we want and we aspire to, it has to come with other things, including economic reform and development and opportunity, or else it can go off the rails. And this is the very precarious state we're seeing in Tunisia. It's not going to end the election. They will move forward, but they have a big problem of discontent, and this is a reflection of it.
How big a problem has that been generally with the post-Arab Spring states, do you think, Oscar? There was that idea that we will install democracy right now and that will fix everything. Have we learnt, I guess, over the last 12 years especially, that installing democracy instantly doesn't fix everything?
I'm not as optimistic. I don't think we really learned from history, but I think Jeffrey hit it on the nail. If you put together massive young male unemployment, which is widespread throughout the region, plus Salafism and Wahhabism, those two elements together, there you go. the source of our troubles.
We will, of course, on Monday next week, be discussing the results of the elections in Tunisia and Brazil. For the moment, we will have to leave it there. Oscar Guardiola and Rivera and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you both, as ever, for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Loads still to come in the second half of today's Midori House, starting with a check-in with our correspondent in Amsterdam, a visit to the musical protesters of Hong Kong, and then a review of the week's new publishing releases. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley is back with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The Canadian Governor-General, David Johnston, has said today that he extends his sympathies to the family of the soldier shot dead by a gunman in central Ottawa on Wednesday, and called the shooting and the consequent attack on Parliament by a reported convert to Islam deeply shocking and saddening. Suspected Boko Haram militants have kidnapped at least 25 girls in an attack on a remote town in northeast Nigeria, despite talks on freeing over 200 other female hostages they seized back in April. European Union leaders are in Brussels for talks on climate change. The summit will focus on agreeing a deal to cut carbon emissions. The European Commission has proposed a 40% cut by the year 2030. And a Tunisian policeman has been killed today when security forces clashed with Islamist militants on the outskirts of the capital, Tunis. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House. It's now 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 in London, it's nearly 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We're heading to Amsterdam today, from where we are joined by Cynthia Taylor. Cynthia, first of all, Holland is, of course, famous for being fairly relaxed about all sorts of generally rock and roll behaviour. They're having to rethink that.
Right. There's something called the Amsterdam Dance Event that takes place every year here in the city and attracts about 350,000 people who for 5 days just enjoy electronic music. But this year there have been at least three deaths that have been reported that are drugs related. Well, what people say is that when you have such kind of events with electronic music, you can never dissociate this with the taking of ecstasy. So basically what some parties are now calling is for a return to the pill testing. These are the vans or tents that used to be on location for partygoers who could just take their pills and get them tested on location. But this were plans that were, it was something that was scrapped in 2002 by the government then, and now people, some more left-leaning parties here are asking for a return of these testing laboratories, we can call them, I suppose.
Is there any clamour from the other side of that, suggesting that if these drugs were legalised or at least tolerated in the way that other drugs are in the Netherlands, these sort of things might not happen?
Not at all, not at all. And that's absolutely not where the debate is going, because it's still pretty much adamant from the government and from most political spectrum that these drugs need to be illegal here because they can be fatal, they can be deadly. What people are saying is, what some people are claiming, including some of the institutes that do test these drugs, is that in fact having these vans stationed at party locations will not change a thing, because people, you know, are in the party mood. They will take the pills if they want to take the pills, basically. And they also say it's a contradiction to the law, because if it's illegal, why would you have then a testing laboratory next to it? And also, what they do point out is the fact that these drugs, the main substance is MDMA. That's what makes ecstasy. And currently, there's a higher risk in taking these drugs because there's a higher percentage of the substance in pills. It's a new tendency. But when you test the drugs, you can you can see whether there is MDMA in the pill, but you cannot say how much. So you cannot say if it's safe. And in fact, what people say is that the only thing we can assure it's safe is if you don't take the pill, because we can never guarantee, you know, what your condition will be after that.
I also wanted to ask about a slightly unusual online crusade undertaken by some Dutch military veterans who are, I believe, trying to out people who are claiming to be Dutch military veterans. Is this a huge problem?
Say if it's a huge problem, but it is something that it's close to the heart of war veterans. I wasn't aware, but apparently there's a lot of people who attend war memorials and pose as war veterans. There are some people who go as far as tattooing the battalion where they supposedly were part in the war, their mission. And there's even a photo of such tattoos on this Facebook page that they started, which actually it tattoos the battalion, but actually with the wrong year. The mission had already ended on that year. And basically these are war veterans and people who are still connected to the Dutch military who just, you know, they just go through photographs that are printed on the media. They check people who go to attend these events, and they just name and shame them on their Facebook page. And after people have apologized, then they just remove the photos and then say, okay, they've apologized and they've promised they will not be doing this again. What they do say is this is a bit of an offense towards those who have, you know, fought and who have put their life at risk, to have some people posing as these war heroes when in fact they are not.
And finally and very briefly, I believe the Netherlands Secretary of State wants to do what I know many despairing license payers here in the UK would like to do to the BBC, which is to stop the state broadcaster from broadcasting stuff which is already perfectly available on commercial channels.
It is true. This is part of a 250 million euro budget cut that the government wants to do in regards to public broadcasting here. It's already started in 2013 and it's going to take place until 2017. And in fact, what the government is saying is that they believe that things like reality television, for instance, should not be paid for by taxpayers' money. They say that the government must have a stronger say on what happens with taxpayers' money regarding public television. So they say that from now on, or from actually 2016, public broadcasters will only be able to produce content which is not made by commercial broadcasters, meaning less entertainment. There'll be more news, more culture, more information and education. And and also in terms of subsidies, they will be slashing from the 70% that are now granted and guaranteed, they will be slashing to 50%, and the remainder of the money they will be giving it to third parties, people who might have an idea of a program that follows these lines of cultural education, to produce a program. And obviously the public broadcasters, because here in the Netherlands we have several companies producing for public broadcasting purposes, they're not very happy with it, and they're saying that they will not be able to compete against the commercial broadcasters, while government says, well, there is still space for entertainment as long as you have a purpose.
Cynthia Taylor in Amsterdam, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we will be finding out what protesters in Hong Kong have been singing, and our guest book reviewer will be talking us through some new releases, including Michael Faber's book of Strange New Things.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hippi, for the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, most modern protest movements have a musical soundtrack. The recent occupation of the streets of Hong Kong by students who'd prefer to decide for themselves who runs their city is no exception. They've drawn on the musical riches of Cantonese culture for something to sing at their sit-ins. Journalist Doug Meigs has this report.
Hong Kong's Umbrella Movement is a protest for the democracy promised decades ago under a framework of one country, two systems. Under a Vast Sky, an early 90s song by the Hong Kong band Beyond, quickly became an anthem for the contemporary protest. It is a song of hope from before the handover to China, at a time when Hong Kong was still a British colony. Recent protests in the city were a reaction to a decision from Beijing, seen by pan-democrats and students as extinguishing hope of genuine universal suffrage in 2017. After police tear gassed protesters on September 28th, a few hundred thousand poured onto the streets. They sang in mass vigils across the city, day and night. Beyond Song is not the only anthem for democracy protesters. Crowds also sang a Cantonese rendition of a tune from the musical Les Miserables. A video of a small girl singing, Can You Hear the Children Sing?, went viral on Hong Kong's social media. Meanwhile, Hong Kong students at Oxford also recorded a tribute. The Cantonese interwebs have been awash with protest songs. Canto pop star Anthony Wong, Denise Ho, and a dozen friends recorded Hold Up the Umbrella in a studio soon after the tear gassing. A group of Form 3 students also quickly released Tear Gas, supporting protesters and lamenting police brutality. There are songs like this. I Promise You an Umbrella, compiled on the Vojo website, Umbrella Songs. One especially vulgar song, with curse words in every line, ridiculed those who criticized the democracy protesters. The song is titled, If I Call You Ong Gao, I'm Afraid You'd Be Mad. Ong Gao is an especially foul term for a stupid person, a bit like calling someone a silly boner.
你咪同我讲，有正有反好平常啫。
These songs have inspired new versions, such as this female cover of the Ong Gao song. There are electronic protest songs, too. YouTuber Jay Fung has remixed a former chief executive candidate accusing Hong Kong's now leader, Tsai Ing-wen, of lying during a televised debate. Jay Fung also remixed media interviews with a fruit knife wielding anti-Occupy troublemaker. One of the more unlikely songs of the Umbrella Movement is a familiar tune, which protesters sang to drown out arguments. The great irony of the Happy Birthday song at protests could be the timing of the Umbrella Movement itself. The Hong Kong-wide call for democracy overlapped with October 1st, which just happened to be the 65th birthday of the People's Republic of China.
Doug Meggs in Hong Kong. It's time now for a bit of music on Midori House. We will stick with the theme established by the previous item. If there's one song which can be, and indeed has been, adapted to pretty much every cause of the modern era, it's this one. You will know it. This is Bruce Springsteen's version.
Hey, we shall. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
None of the books that we're about to discuss with Kathy Rensenbrink, associate editor of The Bookseller, have any large-scale scenes of protest or civil disobedience in them, do they?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, we'll. It was worth a try.
First one's the closest, though. So.
Really? Okay. Let's run with that. Let's see if we can. This is the Michelle Phoebe.
It is. The Book of Strange New Things.
Okay. How do we get to that from Bruce Springsteen's Seeger Sessions album, or vice versa?
There's civil unrest on the streets in part of it in Earth.
That will
on
do
Earth.
Us. Okay. So there's civil unrest on the streets of Earth. I'm guessing from that there are other settings behind this lonely bauble of ours drifting in the bleak infinite of the cosmos.
That is exactly it. The main character in this novel is a big, big brick of a book, and the main character is called Peter Lee. He's a missionary on a very special mission, which involves going on a spacecraft to another planet to bring the word of God to the people there. And he leaves behind his wife, Bee, on Earth.
Is she altogether displeased to see the back of him? He does sound a bit like he might be earnest.
They are very much in love. But they're very... one of the things I think the book achieves is a very... sort of positive, sort of very kind view of Christianity, which I think often in novels, which whatever your religious stance is, that it's quite rare to find people with any kind of belief portrayed in a positive way, I think.
So our chap has voyaged to the very stars in order to spread the good word to the proverbial little green men. But this, presumably, it being Michelle Phoebe, is not merely a science fiction yarn.
No, not at all. And the Book of Strange New Things of the title does refer to the Bible, and that's what the little green men think of. That's what they call the Bible. But actually, it's such a good title because it is just a Book of Strange New Things, and it's a big complex book, but it's probably about love, I think, at the end of the day. But I think all books are about love.
that's a quote they could put on the cover. It's probably about love, I think, at the end of the day. Does it differ specific, because Michelle Phoebe does make something of a point of not doing books which you would expect, or you know, there isn't really a Michelle Phoebe genre as such.
No, there isn't, because he's got Victorian prostitutes. Everything is going on in his oeuvre. I think he can always be relied to do something different, though possibly not anymore, because he's now said that this is going to be his last novel, because he thinks he's now said everything there is to say, that he wants to say.
Given the length of his books, that is a plausible claim. Do we think he means this, or is this just attention-seeking, or just the kind of thing that every author I've ever known has said when they've just finished
a
book?
I don't think he's an attention-seeker. I think he's completely the real deal. What I think is interesting is that at the heart of this novel is a romantic relationship between a man and a woman, and his wife died reasonably recently, and I think he possibly is exploring what it means to love another person through this book, and probably doing that having lost the person that he loves. I think that as you read the book, that is how it feels. It's a love story.
You describe it as a vast brick of a book, which is a description that could be applied to certain of his others as well. I don't know, this I'm just asking this because it's a conversation I run up against quite a lot talking to other writers and agents and book publishing mm-hmm. people. Are people still willing to sit down and plough through 800 or 900 words? Or is that evaporating? Or indeed, were people who wrote books that long just kidding themselves all along anyway?
It's such an interesting subject. Actually, but so many books recently that have been successful have been really long. Obviously, The Luminaries won last year's Man Booker Prize at 900 pages. Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch is enormous. It doesn't seem to be a barrier to people having the attention span to complete them, even though everything we think we know about the modern world should tell us that it is, because apparently none of us have any attention span anymore, but that doesn't seem to be borne out by successful large sales for big books. I think the thing with Michel Faber is, and this is what I've always found about his other, I think almost all books should be shorter. I itch to take a red pen to almost everything I read, but actually almost with the exception of him, because when I finished The Crimson Petal of the Right, which is another about 900 pages, I just wanted it to carry on. Well, it was long, but not long enough for me.
There's another book cover quote. that is high praise indeed. I want to move along to You by Carolyn Kepnes. She has gone, it's a subject visited and much revisited, sort of obsession, stroke, stalking, stroke, etc., which obviously has become, I think, massively enabled by modern communications technology, which has, to a very certain, to some extent or another, I think, made stalkers of most of us, really. where does she go with this idea?
This is great, because this is loads of good fun, this book. I think it's American Psycho crossed with Girls.
So it's the lighter side of obsessive stalking.
It's very funny. I mean, that is the thing. It's extremely funny. And the stalker character is actually quite likeable, though obviously, you know, he's scarily likeable, really. And it is so interesting in the way that it just delineates how people give so much of themselves away now on social media. It has actually made me slightly more careful. I shouldn't even say that, you see, because that's asking for trouble, isn't it? It is terrifying. I mean, as you do read it, you think, yes, you know, the only reason none of us aren't being stalked and murdered is because people can't be bothered, you know, because if they wanted to, they could find out everything they want to know about you online.
Is this the kind of book that has been written with the obvious intention that somebody will make a film out of it?
I don't think so. I mean, you can see it would make a very good film, but it's just a very good, robust, readable, funny, appealing, interesting and intelligent novel. That would be a sort of a good read for everyone.
You talk about that likability with which she endows her protagonist. Mm. That's a tough trick to pull off when you're talking about an obsessive stalker. Is this something she does willfully in order to kind of make the reader feel slightly uncomfortable about whether they like this person or not, or whether indeed to a certain extent they are this person or not?
I think that's it, because as Joe, the character, says, he says quite often things like, well, some people might call this obsessive, but actually for other people it would just be romantic. And you're sort of nodding along and you think, hang on, what have I just agreed with? And he's like, and again, the object of his affections in some ways isn't particularly likeable. And he's a bookseller as well. And I was a bookseller for 10 years. So again, I just think it's sort of crying out for the stuff about bookselling is just spot on. And the stuff, you know, dealing with the public, it's just so brilliant. And then you keep finding yourself like, oh, I'm really rooting for Joe. What am I doing? I'm really rooting for the obsessive murderer.
It's one of my favourite ever Onion headlines. I think I'm quoting it exactly, but the headline was romantic comedy behaviour gets real life man arrested.
That's exactly it. Yes. And that's really what the book is, the extrapolation.
Just finally and very briefly, The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy by Rachel Joyce, the author of The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. She's back.
She is, and this really is a companion novel. So The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry was hugely successful, the best-selling debut for several years, and that was about a man who decided to walk to see his old friend who was dying. This is the other side of the story. This is the old friend who is dying, and she knows that he's walking towards her, and this is her communicating her side of the story to him. It's very lovely, again, actually very funny, very spot on about death, and lots and lots of interesting observations. And a very, very interesting thing happens at the end that I wasn't expecting, but if you read the whole book, people, then look out for that little twist at the end.
Kathy Rensenbrink, as ever, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our earlier special guests, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Jeffrey Kaufman. Today's show was produced by Marika Peters, researched by David Pleasant and Amanda Valmordiba, and our studio manager was Chris Grimes. I'll be back with Emma Nelson at 2200 tonight, London time, for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. I think I'm hosting that as well. But for this edition of the show, it's goodbye and thanks very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.